keyboards, saxophones, and many other instruments to the Kingston community free of charge for almost 20 years. We are a registered charity, relying solely on the generosity of our community to donate their time, money, and instruments to keep this amazing service alive. Find us at www.joesmill.org or Joe's Mill on Facebook for more information on borrowing instruments or contributing to Joe's Mill.
The federal election is on April 28th. Waking up for an early class? That's hard. Voting is easy. You can register and vote on campus from April 13th to 16th. And don't forget to bring accepted ID. Check elections.ca to find out where and when you can vote.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Viewpoints. On this week's show, a local eatery's Friday favorite, fish and chips, will soon be featured in an international cookbook.
What's the most popular pub food? It's fish and chips. You know, we're notorious for it. The place is full every Friday for Fish Friday, and it might be the most popular item on our menu.
Winnipeg's new green spaces plan puts Indigenous knowledge at the forefront. The new policy aims to conserve and expand green spaces by 1,000 acres.
So by moving forward with co-development, the city is supporting its environmental goals while also strengthening a commitment to reconciliation.
Canadian actor Ryan Reynolds hopes that the Ontario Coburg Council Committee will rename the Pond Arena in honor of Grace Bowen, a child who lost her life to cancer 10 years ago.
As long as I live, if I have a free moment for any kid who's carrying a bag of rocks around like that, I will make time for them.
A recently launched a publishing press in New Westminster wants to do things differently.
We've got incredible response from veterans, from Indigenous writers, from LGBTQ authors, from doctors, farmers, people who do all sorts of jobs across this country. And these are the essays that are just starting to come in now.
And the city of Kitchener, Ontario is named as Tree City of the World. Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello to you all. Nice to have you with us. My name is Boris Chassai, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Today, we'll stop in Burnaby, BC, Kitchener and Cobourg, Ontario, and Winnipeg, Manitoba. The city of Kitchener has been named a Tree City of the World by the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations and the Arbor Day Foundation. 21 cities in Canada and 210 cities in 24 countries have also been named with the same title. As we look forward to celebrating Earth Day later this month, the designation reflects Kitchener's efforts in tree care policy development and maintaining a healthy urban canopy. The cities of Hamilton and Cambridge also hold the leafy designation. In a press release announcing the designation, Kitchener Mayor Barry Varbanovich said this recognition is a wonderful indicator that we're moving in the right direction for our community, our forest, and our planet. Dan Keller spoke with Joshua Shea, Manager of Forestry and Natural Area Management at the City of Kitchener.
To achieve the Tree City of the World designation, a city must establish responsibility for trees with dedicated staff, set rules through bylaws and policies, and follow those rules through practices and targets. Know what trees you have through tree inventories and guiding documents, such as Kitchener's Sustainable Urban Forest Strategy. Allocate the resources for the plans to be met through annual budgets, corporate leadership, and council support. And to celebrate achievements through educational efforts, engagement, and public acknowledgments of the work being done. The designation is annual, so the city will have to apply yearly to maintain their status. However, there is no cost to the city to apply for the designation. What is the Tree City of the World recognition, and how did Kitchener get nominated for it?
Yeah, this is an international recognition for cities across the world that take care of trees or promote trees or have a forestry program as part of their municipal work. So the city had applied to this designation and meets the five core criteria to become a Tree City of the World. So in 2024, we were designated as an official Tree City of the World.
So was this like a goal, something your department was looking to accomplish?
Yeah, I mean, these kind of opportunities are a great way to promote the work that we do here at the City of Kitchener, to be able to, you know, showcase and demonstrate how the work that we do is comparable amongst cities across the world. So, you know, it's always something we're looking for, an opportunity to be, you know, showcase and highlight and demonstrate that, you know, we're doing really good stuff here at the City of Kitchener. And you know, we want people to be aware of that.
What does this recognition mean for the city? How will the award influence the city's like environmental strategy?
We already have a really strong environmental strategy and urban forest strategy that guides our work. So, you know, we have a lot of the background work in place to help guide us forward. So if anything, it'll strengthen that work and it'll help us move forward, you know, in the work that we're doing, and help us, you know, get buy-ins in the community or work with the community to advance these goals, and work with our own internal stakeholders as well as council, you know, to try and advance the work of urban forestry. So it helps just kind of raise that bar a little bit.
Now, the other day, city councilors were gushing over the recognition and your department. Are you proud of the work that reflects the designation of a Tree City of the World?
Yeah, absolutely. It's we're extremely proud of it, and me personally as well, being a part of the team that leads this work. You know, it wouldn't be possible without our team and the work that we do. So it's really nice to receive that recognition. We know we have great council support, and they're always behind us on these efforts. So it's, you know, it's a good opportunity to celebrate collaboratively in the work that we're all doing to advance this, you know, between our team and council and the community. So it really speaks to a lot of that. And you know, it's nice to be able to receive the recognition, but it's also a good way for us to continue to work collaboratively together in the future.
Now, in partial celebration of this, there is a tree giveaway on May 3rd. How do people get a tree for that? And what kind of trees are offered? And any fruit trees?
In order to qualify or for people to be able to access and request a tree, they just have to go online, kitchener.ca/trees, and fill out the online form to request a tree. We ask them to fill out a little bit of information about the space they have to plant that tree, so we can help maybe choose a species that makes best sense or will grow in the right space for their yard. So they're not choosing a large tree if they don't have the space, or for example. So there's a variety of different species they can choose from. You know, our target was 210 free trees to be able to give away. So we're monitoring that interest, and we're keeping track of the number of trees and going to order those species. And then on Saturday, May 3rd, we're looking at about 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. So the morning slot to have people drop by, pick up those trees. So there's a variety of different species. I don't know if there's fruit trees at this point. We're looking at canopy trees or other species. But, you know, as interest grows in these programs, we're looking at ways to expand it going forward in the future as well.
What tree species do you appreciate most in the city?
We always have that conversation amongst our team members as to what trees we like and why. Me personally, there's a smaller stature tree called a redbud tree. We don't see it growing too frequently in the city, but it is a popular tree. It just flowers really nicely in the spring. It's great for pollinators. The flowering attracts lots of different pollinators, so I like it for that aspect.
The other really pressing question, of course, everyone's wondering is, do you have a favorite single tree in town, one that maybe you climb or pick fruit from?
I can't say I have a specific tree, but you know, I do find myself as I move through the city, as or I go to various places, I do notice trees and how they're changing throughout the seasons. You know, you see the same tree on the same corner each day, and you get to notice and appreciate and admire it. So I wouldn't say I have a specific tree that I gravitate towards, but I do, you know, I do notice the tree canopy, and I value its benefits, and I appreciate having that as part of my community.
That was an interview with Joshua Shea, the Manager of Forestry and Natural Area Management at the City of Kitchener. Visit kitchener.ca/trees for more information about the Tree City of the World designation. This is Dan Keller. Thank you for tuning in.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
A new policy bylaw adopted by the City of Winnipeg could change the city's future as it aims to conserve and expand the city's green spaces by 1,000 acres. The city is developing its Green Space and Natural Corridors Plan bylaw, as well as a biodiversity policy. The upcoming Green Spaces Plan will be the city's first initiative to protect and expand interconnected natural corridors such as rivers, creeks, and treed streets that support the movement of people, wildlife, and plant species. Here's Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
A new policy and bylaw by the City of Winnipeg opens the door to new opportunities and could change the city's future. The city is developing a Green Space and Natural Corridors Plan bylaw, the Green Spaces Plan, and a biodiversity policy with First Nations, Métis, and Inuit governments and organizations. Shauna Prosiak, a project manager with the City of Winnipeg and co-developer on the Green Spaces Plan, says this effort to integrate Indigenous perspectives and voices into municipal policymaking processes is a vital step in the journey of reconciliation.
We want to ensure that we reflect the interests and values of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit peoples who live here in Winnipeg. And the work that happens in Winnipeg does affect areas beyond our borders. So by moving forward with co-development, the city is supporting its environmental goals while also strengthening a commitment to reconciliation.
Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs Grand Chief Kira Wilson says the efforts of the city to collaborate with First Nations leadership is a positive for all communities in preserving natural areas.
When we talk about spaces within the city of Winnipeg, you know, we need to be able to protect and conserve as many green spaces as we can, you know, that speaks to the, you know, recreational needs of our children and our families, but also the spiritual and cultural practices of not only Indigenous people, but for all people. And so when we think about green spaces, you know, it's also speaking to climate change and climate adaptation and what does that mean for us as, you know, residents within the city of Winnipeg.
The Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs is one of several Indigenous organizations co-developing this policy. The upcoming Green Spaces Plan will be the city's first initiative to protect and expand interconnected natural corridors such as rivers, creeks, and treed streets that support the movement of people, wildlife, and plant species. Grand Chief Wilson says a key aspect of this development is how the principles of two-eyed seeing guide it.
Indigenous or First Nations people, the knowledge that we carry, it comes from our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our ancestors. And so when we think about, you know, all of these different areas that, you know, we need to see Indigenous knowledge incorporated, you know, biodiversity, green spaces, all of that, we need to make sure that we are including the Indigenous knowledge perspective when we are talking about strengths between, you know, Western ways of knowing or Indigenous knowledge and practices.
The project stems from directions in the city's long-term planning documents, including Our Winnipeg 2045 and the Complete Community Strategy. Prosiak says the new policy will aim to conserve and expand green spaces by 1,000 acres, create a bylaw for managing natural corridors, and promote biodiversity.
And a lot of it came out of community input and public engagement about the priorities and importance of natural areas and green spaces to the city. And also how part of it is how we need to create a plan to determine how we protect our green spaces as we're developing our city moving forward.
The next step, phase one of the plan, will involve public and stakeholder engagement through a survey, inviting Winnipeggers to share their thoughts on green spaces and natural areas. Input gathered from the community will be reviewed and used in collaboration with co-developers to create a strategic plan outlining targets, actions, and implementation. The survey is open until April 15th. While the original goal was to present the final policy in 2026, it is now expected to go before the City Council in early 2027 due to the upcoming election year. I'm Ryan Funk.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
So Sharon Hughes has been serving up fish and chips every Friday for nearly two decades at the historic Dominion Hotel in Minden, Ontario. But little did she know that her recipe would one day be included in an international cookbook. Now the Friday fan favorite will be included in a cookbook with hundreds of others from hospitality hotspots around the world. Entitled Inspired Stays Local Flavors, the cookbook is the brain child of Envivo, a cloud-based accommodation booking and management platform, and the Dominion Hotel, in operation since before Confederation, has used the platform. Journalist Elizabeth Oakley in Haliburton, Ontario, spoke with Sean Chamberlain, the owner of the Dominion Hotel. He and his wife were really surprised to be honored with the award.
Every Friday, the Dominion Hotel in Minden serves up its beloved fish and chips to customers. The dish has been on the menu almost as long as the hotel itself, and now it's made its way into a worldwide cookbook. Entitled Inspired Stays Local Flavors, the cookbook is the brainchild of Invivo, a cloud-based accommodation booking and management platform. The Dominion Hotel, which uses the platform, has been recognized for its delicious food and outstanding user experience. Canoe FM recently spoke with Sean Chamberlain, owner of the Dominion Hotel. He and his wife were surprised to be honored with the award and included in a cookbook that features other world-class establishments.
We put an application in just for fun, not thinking that, you know, who cares about Minden and, you know, who cares about a little old 100-plus-year-old hotel. And they liked it. Our recipes are very simple, and we've always strived to be very, very simple, comfort food, you know, good tasting, big servings, but simple. And they like they kind of like the feel, the vibe of that. So they gave us a spot. And we're really honored. I mean, these are people that book, you know, thousands and thousands of reservations, hotel rooms and whatnot a day. It's pretty big time. And the company comes out of Europe, but they've got offices all over the world. And so this is going to be distributed throughout all their offices. So it'll bring some international attention to our little town and our little hotel.
Chamberlain says picking which dish to include in the cookbook was a no-brainer. The Dominion Hotel's fish and chips served up each Fish Friday was the clear choice.
It wasn't very complicated. I mean, we're a pub. What's the most popular pub food? It was fish and chips. You know, we're notorious for it. The place is full every Friday for Fish Friday, and it might be the most popular item on our menu. So we sell a ton of it, and we know that it's good, and the recipe's been the same for a couple of decades. And why not go with it? And part of the book isn't just food. It's also about exceptional experiences. So it's all about, I mean, that's the thing everybody's into these days. They want an experience. They don't just want to go someplace and take a picture and then go home. They want to have felt something when they're there. And we always thought that, you know, the fish and chips, and it's made with our own beer, our 1865 lager. It's a beer battered fish and chips. So we use that in it. So it tells our story. Our first formal recollection of the hotel was from 1865. We know the hotel opened a few years before that, but that predates Canada. So when you talk about an institution, you know, we're 2 years older than Canada as a country. We're one of the oldest operating hotels in Canada, here in downtown Minden.
Besides delicious pub grub, the Dominion Hotel has 6 suites it rents. Originally, the hotel had 14 rooms with a shared bathroom. But Chamberlain and his wife renovated the rooms to include all the comforts of home. Besides those changes, the approach to welcoming guests and diners hasn't changed much in the last century.
You know, the Dominion's been around since 1865. That's a long, long time. And who am I to mess with a formula that works?
The Dominion Hotel is also a live spot for entertainment in Minden. The cookbook, Inspired Stays Local Flavors, is already available for sale on Amazon.
Tune to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
An arena in the city of Cobourg, Ontario, will be renamed after a Grafton child who died of cancer. Grace Bowen died of a rare form of bone cancer in March 2015. Canadian actor Ryan Reynolds became good friends with Grace and her family. He was present at the Cobourg Council Committee meeting last Wednesday, advocating for the arena name change. Grace was an avid hockey player and enthusiast, having spent considerable time at the Pond Arena at the Cobourg Community Center. The suggestion to rename the arena after Grace came following a celebration in Cobourg for the Hospital for Sick Children's 150th anniversary earlier this month. Ian Jones.
The Pond Arena at the Coburg Community Center will soon be named after Grace Bowen. Grace, a Grafton girl, an avid hockey player and fan, died in March 2015 after a battle with osteosarcoma. Grace's warmth and charm led her to meeting actor Ryan Reynolds and hockey star Haley Wickenheiser at a Canada's Walk of Fame ceremony in Toronto. Reynolds was in attendance Wednesday at a Coburg Council committee meeting in favor of renaming the Pond Arena. He recalled when he met Grace backstage at the awards ceremony, saying that moment changed his life.
Just from the moment I met her that night, I said, I'm never, as long as I live, if I have a free moment for any kid who's carrying a bag of rocks around like that, or their parents, I will make time for them. I don't care where or how or when. I spend a half a day each week just doing videos for kids.
The Hospital for Sick Children's 150th anniversary honored Grace with a balloon display at the Grand Center of the Coburg Community Center earlier this month. She would spend many months as a patient at Sick Kids to receive treatment for the rare and aggressive form of cancer. Reynolds relayed that he had a conversation with Grace's father, Greg, following the balloon ceremony last weekend about renaming the pond in Grace's honor.
It sounds like it would be pretty beautiful if we were able to rename the arena, the Grace Bowen Arena, or the Grace Bowen Memorial Arena. I think just Grace Bowen Arena.
Coburg Mayor Lucas Cleveland presented a motion to direct town staff to begin the renaming process. That motion passed unanimously. A timeline on the renaming ceremony has not been given, but Reynolds stated he would attend the ceremony if available. Reporting for the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Dan Jones.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrim, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
To New Westminster, British Columbia now, where the Groove Cats Books and Records, a community used book and record shop owned by husband and wife team John and Kathy Hughes, recently launched the Cosmic Cranium Press. It's an independent publishing press that John Hughes has already used to launch his book, Dream Punk, A Nightscape. Danny Nesvadrani in Burnaby, British Columbia, visited the couple's store, where he spoke with John Hughes to find out more about Cosmic Cranium Press and Hughes' future publishing goals and plans for future titles. He also gave advice to others wanting to make an impact on the independent publishing industry.
Operated and owned by husband and wife duo John and Kathy Hughes, this bookstore has a bi-weekly book club, author talks, and musical sessions by local artists. One of Groove Cat's stated goals is to foster community connection through stories and music. Their next venture to achieve this? Their very own publishing company. To find out more about Cosmic Cranium, CJSF took a trip down to Groove Cat Books and Records, where we immediately found ourselves surrounded by used books, pieces of art, records, and the sounds of light jazz playing on vinyl. When we finally sat down with John Hughes, we asked him to provide an explanation for why Cosmic Cranium Publishing was launched in the first place.
So I was a sessional instructor for a couple of different post-secondary institutions, and I one morning woke up and was cursing at my computer at about 5:30 in the morning, and my wife said to me, "Is this really what you want to do with 15 years in university?" And I responded that no, it wasn't, and her suggestion was, well, let's do something a little more rewarding. So we picked a bookstore, and that went over pretty well in the community. So Groove Cat Books and Records, part of what we aim to do is make things groovier. If you've seen this town, there's not enough soul or groove going on here. There's a lot of concrete, steel condos, high-end dentist offices, and here sort of upscale gyms in the ground floor, and very little in the way of cultural representation. So we wanted to make things at least stick our noses in the area where we thought we could sort of contribute culturally. That's how Groove Cat Books and Records was born. I had a book that I've been working on since my days at SFU in the School of Communication there, which had to do with my research on dreams, and it I had a bunch of almosts in publication. One guy actually suggested that he would pick it up, a guy in Columbus, Ohio, but also wanted me to pay for half of the publication costs. So I thought, okay, you know what? We've got Groovecat Books and Records. Why not start a publication company? And hence, Cosmic Cranium Press was born.
We also asked Hughes if there were any other books in the works that Cosmic Cranium plans on publishing. Here's what he had to say to that.
Canada is not the 51st effing state, and it is going to be a collection of essays by everyday Canadians on not only that, the fact remains Canada will never be the 51st state, but the reasons why people see it this way from personal perspective. And I've reached out in a lot of different directions, and we've got incredible response from veterans, from Indigenous writers, from LGBTQ authors, from doctors, farmers, people who do all sorts of jobs across this country. And these are the essays that are just starting to come in now. The deadline's still open, so if people are interested, hit us up at CosmicCraniumPress.com and look for submissions. And, you know, I mean, if you've got a great idea and the deadline's a little short, we could probably work with you on that. But it's definitely a counterpunch to Donald Trump's ridiculous idea of the 51st state. So we've seen the political response. This is a cultural counterpunch, shall we say.
Afterwards, we asked him to expand on some of the other types of books that he hopes Cosmic Cranium is able to publish.
So that's kind of the spirit of what we do at Cosmic Cranium Press. If there's a problem we don't know about yet, and we should be aware of, and there's ways that people can tackle it head on as individuals or as a community without deference to elites or really anybody who proclaims himself to be, you know, an expert in the field and isn't willing to work with people, then that's something that we would definitely look at. Also, stuff that is, you know, if there's a cultural or political horizon that is about to erupt, that people can research and write about that in a credible fashion. When I say credible, don't get your sources from internet conspiracy stuff. We're not interested at all. Research, you know, on the ground, talking to people, backed up by scholarly research at the same time. This is the kind of stuff that we're looking for. Or if your book just is a real out of left field complete dazzler that, you know, the writing is just so sparkling, we can't say no to, these are the kind of books that we're also interested in.
At the end of the interview, John Hughes left us with some advice that he has for anyone interested in owning their own bookstore or publishing company.
If you open a used bookstore, get a cat. We just lost ours, which is very sad. We will at some point get another, but it's a little raw right now. But get a cat in your bookstore. Very, very key. Connect with your community. Listen to people. Have local authors come in. Have local artists come in. Invite musicians, poets, anybody who wants to be part of the community. When people come in who are interested to hang out and look around, don't worry if they don't buy a book that day, or really ever. It's about community, okay? It's nice to keep the lights on, so if you can afford to buy a book, please do. If you can't, don't sweat it. From the publishing side of things, play your hunches. Go with your heart, but be smart about it, and work your connections. That's really all I have to say about that.
Once again, you were just listening to our conversation with John Hughes, one of the owners of Groovecat Books and Records, as well as Cosmic Cranium Press in New Westminster, BC. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist. Find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
That's all for us at Viewpoints. A big thank you to our journalists this week, Ryan Funk, Ian Jones, Elizabeth Oakley, Danny Nesvedarani, and Dan Keller. Remember to get all our stories on frequencynews.ca. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is produced by the Community Radio Fund of Canada and the Local Journalism Initiative. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassagne. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca. radio@frequencynews.ca.
Thought we were going to win. I said, no, we're going to lose. And I had already mentally prepared for a loss. I needed to wake people up because people thought that the 2018 was a done deal and it was all done and dusted. This loss has woken everybody up to realize what I've been trying to say to them. This is not going to be done until the fat white people in Britain sing. It's going to be a hard fought victory, but I'm going to win. I'm going to win.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm Brian DeShazer. The trans pool pro sues English organizers to play as a woman. Trump tortures Maine over its trans inclusion. And Trinidad and Tobago's champion appeals the latest sodomy ruling. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Rhett.
And I'm David Hunt.
With NewsWrap. A summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending April 12th, 2025. Is pool a gender-affected sport? Transgender professional player Harriet Haynes says it's not, so she's suing the English Blackball Pool Federation. The group that organizes county-level competitions in England only allows people assigned female at birth to compete in the female category for 8-ball. Haynes' lawsuit follows her April 6th win at the Ultimate Pool Women's Pro Series Event 2 in Wigan. She defeated trans player Lucy Smith, among others. Protesters inside the venue at Robin Park Leisure Center held banners saying, "Save women's sport," and "He's a man." Haynes can still compete in some other UK tournaments and play internationally. She's been barred from games sponsored by the English Blackball Pool Federation under a policy set in August 2023. The 34-year-old told Canterbury County Court on April 7th, "My success in pool in general is down to my efforts, whether in the women's section or open section." She credits good coaching and extensive practice for her victories, not biology. Federation attorney Sarah Crowther insisted that pool is a gender-affected sport. She told the court, "All Q sports have protected women's categories because the physique of male players means that male players have an advantage over female players." Crowther confronted Haynes on the nature versus nurture question, probing her assertion that her strengths were the result of practice and technique. Haynes replied, "I would say practice, definitely yes." Crowther then asked Haynes if she would acknowledge that pool is, in fact, gender-affected. Haynes answered, "I'm not an expert on it." For an expert opinion, Haynes submitted a report by an MIT professor. The conclusion there was, there is no inherent male advantage if a player can break above a certain speed, a velocity that can be achieved by both genders. The case continues.
In more transgender sports news, Redmond Sullivan is no longer a member of the Wagner College iconic fencing club. The specifics of her departure remain a secret, and references to her tournaments have been removed from the Staten Island, New York private university's website. Sullivan was catapulted into the national spotlight in March when cisgender female opponent Stephanie Turner protested her inclusion in the Cherry Blossom Open. Turner forfeited the match and posted a statement that went viral. Sullivan was a member of Wagner's men's fencing team during the 2023 to 2024 season. She has competed for the women's team in several matches during the first half of the current season. Turner represents the Fencing Academy of Philadelphia. She had finished four earlier matches at the Cherry Blossom Open before she was set to face Sullivan. Until the anti-transgender executive orders of the Trump administration, the National Collegiate Athletic Association was in sync with the inclusive policies of USA Fencing and its international governing body. Now the NCAA has declared, a student athlete assigned male at birth may not compete on a women's team. In response to the Sullivan controversy, USA Fencing stood by the 2023 policy, its statement said, was designed to expand access to the sport of fencing and create inclusive, safe spaces. Sullivan's own iconic fencing club initially supported her. They insisted, following the Cherry Blossom tournament incident, that she had adhered to all of USA Fencing's rules and guidelines, and stressed the sport's deep tradition of honor, sportsmanship, inclusion, and respect. However, now Sullivan is gone, and all Wagner College spokesperson Jim Chiavelli will say is, we are in full compliance with NCAA and NEC rules and regulations. The fencer is not a member of our fencing team. Meanwhile, the U.S. Department of Education and the Department of Justice have launched a discrimination investigation into USA Fencing's trans-inclusive policy.
The issue of transgender student athletes is part of the reason federal education funding for the state of Maine is being frozen. That's the Trump administration's way of punishing the state for refusing to ban transgender girls and women from competing in school female sports. The freeze was announced last week by U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Brooke Rollins. Maine's Attorney General Aaron Frey has now asked a federal judge for a temporary restraining order to release those funds. Maine argues that the money being withheld is used to feed school children and disabled adults. Frey charged that Rollins was acting more like a hostage taker seeking a ransom payment than a cabinet-level federal official. Democratic Governor Janet Mills' February 21st run-in with Trump over Maine's support for trans female athletes went viral.
Is Maine here, the governor of Maine? Huh? Are you not going to comply with it?
Fine with state federal laws.
We are the federal law. So you better comply, because otherwise you're not getting any federal funding.
I'll see you in court.
Agriculture Secretary Rollins responded to Maine's lawsuit defiantly, claiming, you cannot openly violate federal law against discrimination in education and expect federal funding to continue unabated. Rollins extended the false narrative with, this is only the beginning, though you are free to end it at any time by protecting women's and girls in compliance with federal law. The state is also being punished for violating Trump policy by refusing to transfer trans female prisoners to male facilities. Maine's Department of Corrections confirms that the U.S. Justice Department has canceled grants that support post-relief supervision and reentry services, according to Maine Morning Star. These resources help prevent recidivism and reduce crime. In a media statement, Maine's Attorney General Frey proclaimed that Trump is not above the law and Maine will not be bullied into violating state law.
Queer-themed titles top the American Library Association's list of the most banned books for the fourth consecutive year. Number one and number two are All Boys Aren't Blue by George M. Johnson and Gender Queer by Maya Kobabe. They've both been on the list since 2021. There have been no substantial changes in the ALA list since 2023. The top 10 banned books also include Flamer by Mike Curato, The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison, The Perks of Being a Wallflower by Stephen Chbosky, and Looking for Alaska by John Green. Director of the ALA's Office for Intellectual Freedom, Deborah Caldwell Stone, told NBC News that parental challenges only accounted for 16% of the complaints. She said Moms for Liberty and other far-right groups are behind the majority of the demands to have a book yanked from the library shelves. Most involved false claims of illegal obscenity for minors. according to the ALA report. Other hot topics included anything dealing with race, racism, diversity, equity, inclusion, and social justice. The attacks on books has a chilling effect on librarians who are increasingly reluctant to stock books that may be controversial. According to the ALA's Caldwell Stone, librarians don't want to get prosecuted or otherwise face legal trouble. A lot of librarians are operating under these kinds of threats. It can get worse. The Trump administration has ordered the virtual elimination of the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Dozens of grants to state and local libraries are outright canceled. Those actions are already being challenged in court.
Finally,
how low can you go?
White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt says, as a matter of policy, we do not respond to reporters with pronouns in their bios. The Trumpian reasoning? Leavitt told the New York Times this week, any reporter who chooses to put their preferred pronouns in their bio clearly does not care about biological reality or truth, and therefore cannot be trusted to write an honest story. Crooked Media reporter Matt Berg told the Times, I find it baffling that they care more about pronouns than giving journalists accurate information. But here we are. Soon after his inauguration, Trump's Office of Personnel Management denounced gender ideology and sent a memo to the entire federal workforce, essentially forbidding references to personal pronouns in all workplace communications. The White House lost another word game this week. A federal judge ordered it to reinstate the Associated Press to briefings and related media-attended events. Its reporters had been exiled for refusing to comply with a Trump edict to change the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending April 12th, 2025. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon and Lucia Chappell, produced by Brian DeShazer, and brought to you by you.
Thank you. Help keep us in ears around the world at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast and much more. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt. Stay healthy.
And I'm Rhett. Stay safe.
Brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother, brother to brother.
This is Essex Hemphill, reminding you that you've tuned into This Way Out.
Homophobia, turn me around. Keep on a walking, keep on a talking.
Our listeners support This Way Out in many ways.
By subscribing to our e-newsletter.
Email us at info@thiswayout.org.
And through your financial contributions to our program.
More information about how you can give is online at thiswayout.org.
Thank you.
The mighty rise to meet the challenge.
Yeah, we stand and we fight and we shall not fail.
Now is the time for action.
Tell them you're ready now, come with me.
So let me choose the love, yeah.
And together we can move the clouds from great to fine and make sunshine TNT. There's no greater time than now.
The Caribbean Republic of Trinidad and Tobago is stuck in a time warp. Its 16th century British colonial era ban on same-gender intimacy was struck down in 2018, only to be reinstated by an appeals court just a few weeks ago. However, it's not the end of the fight for the rights of Trinidad and Tobago's 100,000 LGBTQ plus citizens. This Way Out's David Hunt met the activist who has led the way as he pushes for the next and final round of legal challenges.
Crowds on the steps of the Hall of Justice in Port of Spain, the capital city of Trinidad and Tobago, erupted in cheers on learning that the High Court had struck down the Caribbean nation's archaic anti-gay sodomy statutes. But that was then, April 12, 2018. 7 years later, March 25, 2025, the silence outside the courthouse was deafening.
That was the day, just a few weeks ago, that a three-judge appeals court panel overturned the high court ruling, putting the anti-gay laws back on the books. But there's one voice that refuses to be silenced.
It's going to be a hard-fought victory, but I'm going to win. I'm going to win.
That voice belongs to Jason Jones, a biracial, binational, queer activist who sued his home country in 2017, asserting that the colonial-era ban on gay sex violates his constitutional rights to privacy, liberty, and freedom of expression. Jones, who has fought for human rights on two continents for four decades, isn't about to stop now. He's appealing the appellate court decision, and this time the courtroom drama will play out in London before the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, at a place where a medieval refuge called Sanctuary Tower once stood. If that's an omen, it's one Jones will readily embrace as he fights to overturn laws that date to the reign of Henry VIII. I'm David Hunt. The island nation of Trinidad and Tobago, the southernmost country in the Caribbean, gained independence from the United Kingdom in 1962 after 160 years as a British Crown colony. But that history is not as remote or irrelevant as it seems. With the breakup of the British Empire after the Second World War, it was common for former British colonies to insert language into their constitutions, protecting existing colonial-era laws from being challenged on constitutional grounds. This language was called a savings clause or savings law clause, and it did just that. It preserved the legal status quo as former colonies transitioned to independence. But in some former colonies, including Trinidad and Tobago, that created a problem. The world has changed a lot since the waning days of the British Empire. Laws covered by the savings clause have not. Even though Trinidad and Tobago adopted a new constitution in 1976 when it became a republic, and even though that more modern constitution has been amended more than a dozen times, the savings clause is still there, still in effect. And among the old British laws it protects from judicial challenge is the Sexual Offences Act. Section 13 of that act criminalizes buggery, an old English word for sodomy, while Section 16 criminalizes serious indecency between persons of the same sex. Buggery became part of English common law in 1533, giving King Henry VIII more control over vices that had been policed by the Catholic Church. It remained a capital offense until 1861. Jason Jones, who now lives in London, seat of a more constrained monarchy, grew up in Trinidad and Tobago, where he saw the impact of Britain's colonial legacy firsthand. While Britain decriminalized gay sex in 1967 and approved same-sex marriage in 2014, its former colonies are largely stuck in the past, an anti-gay past.
Well, that's the thing with colonialism. You know, they gave us independence and that was it. They didn't give us anything else. So it's like, here you are, freedom, and fuck off. But what that did was it left us 50 years behind the global north. So not only did they just walk out, wash their hands and say, fuck off, you're free, but they then hamstrung us with the savings clause so that we couldn't even get out of this cycle of violence that they have within British colonialism.
The legal strategy behind Jones's case was mapped out by London solicitor Peter Laverack, then studying to become a barrister. He discovered that Trinidad and Tobago had changed its Sexual Offences Act three times in 1976, 1986, and 2000. Because the law had been changed, Laverack asserted, it could no longer be protected from judicial challenge by the savings clause. The original law was effectively gone. The strategy found a receptive party in High Court Justice Devendra Rampersad, who ruled against the government in April 2018, striking down the anti-gay sections of the Sexual Offences Act. The ruling surprised everyone. Well, almost everyone.
I knew we had presented such a powerful case, and the judge, Justice Devendra Rampersad, who is a Hindu pundit in his private life, had said very early on in the case that religion had no place in this matter. He knew that there would be a lot of religious stuff thrown around, but he's not entertaining it. This is a human rights issue, constitutional issue.
7 years later, in March 2025, as the appellate court prepared to render its verdict on the government's appeal, thinking had changed. This time, Jones was the pessimist.
My lawyers thought we were going to win. I said, no, we're going to lose. And I had already mentally prepared for a loss.
Two of the three judges on the appellate panel, Justices Nolan Barreau and Charmaine Pemberton, ruled for the government. And just like that, the Sexual Offenses Act, with its anti-gay sodomy sections, was saved. But that's not the end of the road or this story. The next chapter is set in London. Will the Empire strike back or strike out? You're listening to This Way Out, the international LGBTQ radio magazine. I'm David Hunt. Jason Jones, a biracial, binational queer activist, sued his country of birth, Trinidad and Tobago, in 2017 to overturn anti-gay sections of the Caribbean nation's Sexual Offenses Act. He unexpectedly won the first round in court in 2018, then, just as unexpectedly, lost on appeal this year, 2025. Even though Trinidad and Tobago is an independent republic with its own courts, its legal system is rooted in Britain's colonial era. A quirk of that legacy is that Trinidad and Tobago's Court of Final Judgment does not sit in Port of Spain, the capital city. It's called the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, and it sits in London in the Supreme Court building. Later this year, the council will take up the case of Jones versus Trinidad and Tobago. Jones explains.
The appeal is in process. I have 21 days, so we're drafting the appeal now. Even though it's not a great position to go into the appeal at the Supreme Court level, I needed to wake people up because people thought that the 2018 was a done deal and it was all done and dusted. This loss has woken everybody up to realize what I've been trying to say to them. This is not going to be done until the fat white people in Britain sing. And that's where we're headed. And listen, it's going to be a difficult victory, for sure.
The journey that led Jones to London and to prominence as a queer activist began in Trinidad and Tobago, where he was born shortly after the country gained independence, and where he grew up in a family and community that encouraged his love of the performing arts.
I sang solo in the churches. My grandmother played the organ in the Catholic Church, so I was a kind of central figure in the Catholic Church choirs. Then got involved with performing and theater, and you know, that kind of became my queer family. As I tell people, I never came out. My parents outed me when I was about 14 because of the homophobic bullying that I was receiving. Luckily, I had very enlightened parents who weren't afraid to deal with what the issue was. Both my parents were journalists, so they were both very intelligent and very aware of homosexuality and were friends with gay men. So, you know, this was not an unknown quantity to them.
Jones also cites the influence of his stepfather, Black Power activist Rex LaSalle, for encouraging his self-acceptance and self-reliance. LaSalle gained fame in April 1970 when, as an army lieutenant, he led a mutiny against the government, refusing orders to fire on citizens during a brutal crackdown of the Black Power movement.
You know, Rex was seen as quite a hero of the Black civil rights movement around the world, not just in Trinidad. So by the time he was living with us in our home, you know, it was very clear to me that this was a person of great importance. It always kind of led me to believe that I could do whatever I wanted, you know, that I had a choice.
LaSalle made it possible for Jones to make a move that would change his life, a move across an ocean and across a cultural divide to 1980s London.
It was in London where Jones took his first steps as a human rights activist, joining protests against the UK's notorious Section 28.
Section 28 was a law passed by Margaret Thatcher and the Conservatives, which forbade the promotion of homosexuality, which in effect meant that libraries couldn't stock books, teachers couldn't speak about it in schools. You know, it literally, anything in the public domain that was funded by government, you couldn't mention anything to do with homosexuality.
Jones was also instrumental in the late 1990s in clearing the way for the foreign partners of gays and lesbians to legally reside in the UK, a victory that led to civil partnerships and then to marriage equality. In the mid-1990s, Jones was back in Trinidad and Tobago, where he founded the Lambda Group, the first LGBTQ advocacy group in the Southern Caribbean. At the same time, he became the target of homophobic threats after performing in drag.
It was soul-destroying, especially as, you know, there was no safety whatsoever. I mean, the American embassy offered me their plane to get me off the island. But I knew at that point that if I did accept that, it would, number one, reinforce the narrative that gay is a white man disease from the global north. And two, it would also kind of, you know, I didn't want to be seen as this coward that dropped a bomb and then turned tail and ran at the first sign of problems. So I literally had to write it out.
The violent backlash to Jones's drag performance drove him back to London, but it also drove him into court, spurring his lawsuit against Trinidad and Tobago and its Anti-Gay Sexual Offenses Act. Ironically, that lawsuit now follows him to London. A ruling in Jones's favor could lead to the decriminalization of same-sex intimacy in other Commonwealth countries, potentially impacting millions of LGBTQ people in former UK colonies.
The thing with the JCPC is that even though they're white, British, and sit in London, when they sit on a matter like this, it's as if they're sitting in Trinidad and Tobago. So it's one thing to say, oh, well, you know, throw our hands up, we have nothing to do, it's a savings clause. But it's another one to condemn LGBTQ plus people to a society that's endemically homophobic using laws that you created. So it's going to be a hard-won battle, for sure.
For his part, Jones is ready to pass the torch of activism to the next generation, a generation he hopes to inspire to carry that torch proudly and bravely, as he was inspired by his mentors.
I don't want to be here forever. I literally want to sling my hang up between two coconut trees and sip pina coladas and mentor. That's it. I do not want to be in the cut and thrust of advocacy anymore.
I'd like to thank Jason Jones for sharing his story for this feature. For This Way Out, I'm David Hunt.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. NewsWrap was reported this week by Rhett and David Hunt and produced by Brian DeShazer. Our correspondent was David Hunt. Chubby Checker, The Rolling Stones, The No Greater Time Collective, and The Hilltop Trio performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, Steve Sims of Seattle, Washington, and Richard Merck and Brad Payton of Silicon Valley. Listener donors make this program possible. Ask us about how you can join them. Email us at info@thiswayout.org or write us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon, associate producer Lucia Chappell, and the entire This Way Out crew, I'm Brian DeShazer. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And on KSKQ, Ashland, Oregon, WOZO, Knoxville, Tennessee, 2MTM, Coonabal, New South Wales, and a wide array of community terrestrial and internet radio stations around the world, including this one. Stay healthy, stay safe, and stay tuned.
CFRC 101.9 FM is so thrilled to announce the launch of our brand new accessible website at cfrc.ca. Get your local news, stream your favorite shows, and stay up to date with upcoming events. You can share news tips, book a recording studio, request a PSA for AirPlay, and oh so much more.